And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
What's going on? The stories of earthquakes, hurricanes, historic rainfalls, and massive flooding around the world are what? An indication of an unusual dramatic change taking place? Or are we just hearing and seeing more now because of our 24/7 news coverage from around the world? No one's quite sure. So today we tell it as we see it, as we go in depth with the right whale for all the wrong reasons, when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
It's often hard to see change happen, unless it's catastrophic, like the sudden devastation being felt around the world this past month from an unbelievable series of floods that are displacing millions around the world, the earthquakes that seem to have started some kind of chain reaction, a major 7.9 quake just rocked Peru. But most change, organic change, is gradual, and we often cannot even really sense it until we find that reminder, like a photograph of our family from 12 years ago, or meeting someone's six-year-old that you hadn't seen for 2 years. I've tried to remember being really small, like as a child, and the most vivid image I can conjure up is standing up with a neighborhood friend reaching deep into a grapevine that covered the fence between our yards to pick some little sour grapes. We were both shorter than the fence itself. Right now on the earth, we are going through a period of change, dramatic changes, as thousands of animal species simply disappear. You don't notice their disappearance suddenly, if you notice it at all. It's just that each season, there are fewer. Over the years, our memories accommodate to the new reality. If I think about it, I can really sense the dramatic disappearance of butterflies. When I was younger, butterflies had a relative density in the air. Big, impressive butterflies like the monarchs or tiger swallowtails. Now I rarely see any. Today we're going to talk with a scientist who is in the initial phase of a 4-year study of the northern right whales, which, if we're lucky, may actually be as plentiful as scientists are estimating, which is somewhere perhaps between 50 and 100 on the entire earth. A couple of hundred years ago, the right whale was the whale of choice for the whaler, hence its name, and grand whaling fleets set out on quests to hunt the whale, primarily for its oil, which was used to light the lamps around the world. Back then, there were no real estimates of the number of whales in the world. There were so many, no one was even keeping track. But slowly, each year, there were fewer. And now, there are, if we are lucky, 50 to 100 right whales left on the earth. It occurred to me the other day, as I read again about the projection that there will be no harvestable fish in the oceans by 2040, and the chimpanzees are still being killed as bushmeat, and as we scrape the bottom of the seas for anything edible, that we are about to eat ourselves into despair as the wonders of the wild creatures disappear forever. Can we turn this around? My guess is, I'm sorry to say, probably not. Some may say it's pessimistic, but I listen to the presidential debates and I hear not a single question, comment, or concern being raised about the real state of our world, just as in the last election when I remember hearing one question about the environment during the entire series of debates. And here we are 4 years later, with unprecedented flooding and storms driving millions of people from their homes, with the devastation of Katrina forgotten, with reports continuing from around the world that gorillas, cheetahs, bees, orangutans, rhinos, whales, and thousands of other species are in massive decline. While our leaders are given 30, 60, and 90 seconds to address the pressing issues of our day in the Democratic and Republican Party debates. And yet, not a word about the real state of the environment and our Earth. In today's second segment, we're heading up to Seattle to the National Marine Mammal Laboratory as they assess the possible effects of new oil and gas leases being let out on the Bering Sea, where it just so happens right whales have been spotted with calves in recent years. But first, we continue our summer series of Weekly Earth Science. Welcome to the Weekly Earth Summit, the most important 15 minutes on Earth. I'm your host, Sidney Wildsmith, and we continue receiving updates from our regular panel of experts on nature and the environment. We begin today's summit with an honest assessment of the efforts to help the chimpanzee and other similarly challenged species from Dr. Mark Beckhoff, who comments on the current efforts of Jane Goodall. Dr. Beckhoff?
Progress in that field goes slow. I mean, people are still extremely concerned about the precarious situation of the great apes. The bushmeat trade is still going, and so, you know, animals are being killed and eaten, and as a result, there's a lot of orphans. And I think, you know, it's the same old, but I think we're making a difference in terms of the availability of suitable habitat. The retention of land, suitable habitat for species, is really paramount. You know, it's hard enough to keep the land when the animals are there. And then if you have, you know, conservation programs where you say, well, we're taking care of these animals in captivity with the hope of re-releasing them or releasing them later on, please put that land aside. There's no developer in the world who's going to put the land aside. So, you know, it's almost like it has to be an immediate situation where you can go, look, we need the land because we're putting chimpanzees out, or we need the land because we're putting wolves out, or some endangered antelope. But if you try to do the rehab projects and save the land when the animals aren't there, it's very difficult. So I'd have to say that we're making progress, but it's certainly slow. There are changes in the welfare standards in a lot of food industries that, once again, a lot of people think it's, you know, not enough, but while it's not enough, at least things are moving, you know, in some way.
Thanks, Dr. Beckhoff. We certainly are all concerned about the future of the natural world, but we humans face some amazing new challenges as we try to accommodate to this new world order. Dr. Charles Kennel always sees through the issues of societal restructuring and hopes for light at the end of the tunnel. Dr. Kennel.
I was very impressed with the International Council on System Engineering, and they had 900 people come to a meeting in San Diego, and they think holistically about the systems that they build. It has many, many components and working parts, and so they are already now beginning to think about sustainable engineering. We heard a discussion of all the challenges of modernizing the London Underground, a huge energy producer, a crucial transporter, 4 million people, I think, a day. It's a huge number, a tremendous responsibility, and making a contribution already, clearly, through public transport, making a contribution to minimizing London's greenhouse burden. But it's a 150-year-old organization, and how do you get new ideas in, and how does one infuse a whole set of new ideas and practices into a system that can't miss a beat? It has to meet its requirements every day, and it has people who have done so successfully for a long time, and now they're being asked to change. And how do you infuse new ideas into ongoing organizations that are absolutely critical to the functioning of society? Well, the system engineers do think about things like that, how to deal with the customer, the human response to the system changes. And so they have a discipline that is clearly going to participate in the transformation of the way we do things in many of our human systems. And so, yes, you begin to see them thinking about it.
Thank you, Dr. Kennel. And that brings us to this week's final Weekly Earth Summit commentary from Emma Sleeth, student, writer, and an emerging environmental wit, as she puts her spin on her version of Dr. Kennel's dilemma. Emma?
Yesterday, my brother updated the hardware on his computer so that he could do video editing for my parents. Yet there was one problem. His hands were too big, so he enlisted my help. Apparently, my hands were just the right size to fit into the small nooks and crannies of his computer case. And yet there was another problem. I'm completely clueless when it comes to technology. So we did it together. He would tell me what needed to be connected to what, and I would do the actual connecting. It took us a little while, but we finally got a system going where he would point to what he needed done with a pencil, and then I would execute his directions. I would go, "The little twisty thingy goes on the little prongy thingy?" And he would smile and say, "Yes, the 4-pin Molex connector from the PSU connects to the HDD." It's the same thing with the environment. Some of us know the big picture, or the science of climate change, whereas others of us can follow their directions and make the actual changes. Even though I could not tell you how a fluorescent bulb works, I know how to replace incandescent bulbs with more energy-efficient ones. It's a symbiotic relationship. Some of us have the knowledge, and some of us have the right-sized hands to bring the suggestions to fruition. So if I plant the greeny thingy in my yard, it will make the air stuff better? Yes, the scientists smile. If you take care of the planet, it will be a better place.
That's Emma Sleeth, as always. We'll hear a lot more from Emma Sleeth in the months ahead, here on the Weekly Earth Summit. Thanks, Emma. And thank you for joining us again for the Weekly Earth Summit, the most important 15 minutes on Earth. Right whale is spelled righthwhale. That's surprising to many who think naturally it would be righthwhale. You may be surprised at the right answer to this minor vexation when we go in depth with the right whales when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us, hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
The good news is, research is beginning, finally, on one of the most endangered species on the planet, the northern right whale. The bad news is, the research is the result of proposed oil and gas leases being promoted along the reported feeding grounds of the endangered right whale in the Bering Sea off Alaska's western coastline. We launch this in-depth inquiry into one of the most telling battles of our age as an endangered species comes up against an old technology when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News. Today, we head up to Seattle to talk with Dr. Alex Zerbini of the National Marine Mammal Laboratory as he begins a four-year study of the right whale, which is, without doubt, one of the most endangered species on the planet. Unfortunately, their winter feeding grounds are being designated as the refuge for massive offshore oil and gas installations. There's a giant battle looming as these two titans, one of industry, the other of the seas, face off in the Bering Sea. That's coming up following this week's Nature News. So first, the news. The U.S. Navy was ordered to suspend their use of sonar during submarine training missions off the Southern California coast through 2009. In 1997, states were given the right to enforce environmental regulations off their coasts. This formed the basis for the California Coastal Commission to battle the Navy over their use of sonar. However, in January, the Navy rejected the Commission's rulings based on national security, which were backed up by a Pentagon decision to exempt the Navy from the Marine Mammal Protection Act for 2 years. The U.S. Circuit Court decision essentially overrode the Pentagon's claim of exemption. The case is expected to move on up to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. One of Time Magazine's Heroes of the Planet was held in jail for 2 months of a 16-year sentence following his conviction for selling naming rights to two monkey species he discovered while working for Brazil's National Institute for Amazon Research. Dutch scientist Mark van Roosmalen planned to use the money raised from the eBay auction to preserve their habitat. Dr. van Roosmalen was released from jail on appeal with backing from hundreds of scientists from around the world who claim that science is being criminalized. Van Roosmalen blames the powerful logging interests and overzealous environmental regulators for colluding to bring about his conviction. Tropical Storm Erin, the first serious storm in the Gulf of Mexico this year, is barreling towards the Texas shore and is expected to make landfall today. A tropical storm warning is in effect for the Texas coast from Brownsville to San Luis Pass near Galveston. Oil workers are being pulled from oil rigs in the Gulf in anticipation of the impending storm. Oil futures rose with the possibility of a hit on oil supplies where a third of U.S. oil is produced. Tens of millions remain homeless in India and Bangladesh as the worst flooding in memory devastates the area. The waters in some areas are beginning to recede, but dysentery is setting in as fresh water, food, and medicine have not reached the vast homeless who have lost almost all of their worldly goods. Meanwhile, in North Korea, hundreds are dead and missing in the aftermath of the worst flooding ever recorded. Early estimates are that 30,000 homes have been destroyed by the floods. The world's largest freshwater lake is approaching the lowest level ever recorded due to severe decreases in rain and higher summertime temperatures. Lake Superior has seen its level drop precipitously during the last decade and has dropped by over a foot in the last year alone. Tributaries to the lake are drying up, and Lakes Huron and Michigan are also down more than 3.3 feet in the last decade. As water levels drop, so too the amount of grain and iron ore, which are barged downriver to the Atlantic as ships must lighten their loads to accommodate the reduced water levels. Bluefin tuna in the Mediterranean Sea and East Atlantic Ocean are nearing extinction because of massive illicit fishing. This, according to the World Wildlife Fund. Most of the tuna is being shipped to Japan, where tuna prices can be as much as $15 a pound. A single large adult tuna can sell for $50,000. The World Wildlife Fund has asked the European Union to close bluefin tuna fisheries on an interim basis and the implementation of a strict recovery plan to allow adult fish to mature. And finally, California ground squirrels have a most unique defense against rattlesnakes. When a ground squirrel and a rattler face off, scientists have noted that the ground squirrel will raise its tail and shake it, and this has been an effective deterrent to further attack by the rattlesnakes. Now, scientists know why. Why? The ground squirrel directs blood to its tail, thereby heating it up, which frightens the snake away, as rattlers rely on very sensitive thermal imaging to hunt their prey. The tail of the squirrel can rise by as much as 9 degrees Fahrenheit, which is enough to deter further attack. As a matter of fact, the poor rattlers take on a defensive posture to protect themselves from the hot tails of the squirrels. And that's the news. It's obvious that there are dramatic shifts in the natural balance of our planet. In many cases, such as the unusual flooding, storms, and drought, global weirding is emerging forthwith. As well, the human population has taken a direct toll on hundreds and now thousands of animal species. The story you are about to hear is an indicator of the challenges ahead. We certainly live in the era when the discussions of extinction, mass extinction, some people are referring to, are in the news all the time, and that's because there are many, many, many species that are just disappearing right now as the interaction of humankind and the space and needs that they require, the resources that they draw up, the places that they live that they didn't used to before, and impact are really just trampling over the existence and the rights of other creatures to inhabit their lands as well. And so we hear a lot of stories. Certainly, one of the families of animals that so many people are drawn to are the whales, the magnificent and extraordinary whales, for reasons that are very deep in our souls, very likely. There are some success stories, and there's a lot of effort globally to really protect these animals, but as well, there are some real difficult challenges. And certainly, one of the grandest challenges is the future of the right whales. To discuss this, we're now calling up to Seattle and talking to Dr. Alex Zerbini, who's with the National Marine Mammal Laboratory. Dr. Zerbini, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, Dr. Zerbini, you're a very lucky person because you have the opportunity to really spend your life studying whales. Why don't you give me a little history of your involvement in whale research?
Well, I started studying whales in 1992 in Brazil, which is where I'm originally from. And I work for a museum there doing beachcombing, looking for marine mammal carcasses. Later on, I got a master's on taxonomy, working primarily with minke whales. And in 1999, I moved to Seattle to get my PhD here at the University of Washington, working on mainly on killer whales, minke whales, humpback, and fin whales. And I graduated in 2006. And since then, I've been working for the National Marine Mammal Lab, primarily on population ecology of large whales, including the right whales, which are the main focus of our studies now.
Talk a little bit about what the National Marine Mammal Laboratory, what the mission is, and also who they're associated with.
Well, the National Marine Mammal Laboratory is a government organization within the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and we are responsible for conducting research on marine mammals throughout the North Pacific and especially the Alaskan waters. The lab has several groups working on all sorts of marine mammals, which include seals and sea lions and whales and small cetaceans.
Your focus currently is on the right whales. Tell us a little bit about the right whales, a little bit about their history, and then why it is that they're being so intimately studied right now.
The right whales are one of what we call baleen whales. They are plankton feeders. And they reach about 60 feet in length and weigh approximately 100 tons. The right whales is called right whales because the whalers in early the 17th and 16th century thought that they were the right whales to kill because once they were, first because they were very, very rich in blubber, in fat, and second, because they were easy to take. They were relatively slow, easy to approach, easy to harpoon. And after they were dead, they would float on the surface. Unlike many other whale species that sink after being killed, the right whale floats. So it would be easy to take those whales and then tie a rope around the whale or the whale fluke and then tow them back to land. The right whale was heavily hunted in the North Pacific in the 19th and the 20th centuries, and was in 1935 protected by international organizations. Even though the species was protected, in the eastern North Pacific, about 370 whales were killed in the Gulf of Alaska and the Bering Sea by illegal Soviet whaling in the 1960s. The reason we're so focused on this population today is it's because it's probably the most endangered stock of whales in the world. And it has a very, very small population, believed to be between 50 and 100 individuals.
Well, we'll talk a little bit more about that and what that really means, because that's a very significant detail. At this point, one of the reasons that now there is research is because there are oil and gas leases that are being let out in the Bering Sea, which has direct bearing, at least potentially, on the future of the right whales. Some people are suggesting there have been recent sightings of the right whale in the Bering Sea, mothers with their calves. That's a very strong bond between the mother and the calf, such that people say, well, I think these animals are actually here, because there's not much known about where they actually live and travel. So there is now research going on to determine where these populations are and their habits, and you've been involved in that. Why don't you talk about what's been happening most recently in terms of trying to learn more about the right whales?
This is right. This project that we are starting now this year is actually a four-year project that is funded by the United States Mineral Management Service. And the main focus of this study is to assess seasonal distribution and abundance and movement of right whales in the areas to adjacent to the North Aleutian Basin, which is the proposed area for oil and gas lease sales. What we want to do with this project is characterize the right whale habitat, the foraging behavior, the health, and the prey distribution of these animals. It is very important to do that because this is such a small population and because we know very, very, very little about what's going on with those whales.
Am I right about the fact that the sightings probably are extremely rare? Is that correct?
Yes, they are extremely rare.
Mm-hmm. Because there's so few animals, and as well, we don't have good scientific information about where they are. What do we know at this point about the very few animals that are remaining?
Well, we've had sightings of whales, of right whales, mainly some in the Gulf of Alaska, but mainly in the Bering Sea, in the last at least in the last decade. We know more or less where they go during the feeding season. We know at least part of the habitat. And recently, we had proposed to delineate an area in the Bering Sea called the critical habitat. That's what we know, and we've seen some animals there. We've taken pictures for like individual identification, taking biopsy samples. So, and that's pretty much it. We don't know if that's the whole entire habitat used in the summer for feeding grounds, for example. We don't know where those whales go in the winter, which is probably their breeding season. We don't know which migratory routes they use. We don't know if there are other feeding habitats within the Bering Sea or the Gulf of Alaska. So we know very little. That's what we know.
That's the bottom line, yeah,
yeah.
Which unfortunately in this particular situation makes it extremely difficult to know what to do, because if we're going to apply some sort of scientific intelligence at trying to help these animals, we don't have much to go on. Unfortunately, the animals tend to like to, from my understanding, and you know a lot more about this than I do, so I'll pose things and you can correct me as appropriate, but apparently they tend to like to hug the coastline more than stay out in the deep waters, and this is where, in particular, the possibility of oil and gas leases off the shore within the Bering Sea could come in direct conflict with these animals. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. What we know is that they tend to use more coastal, shallower areas in the Bering Sea. But again, they could be offshore, and we just don't know that because we haven't been there looking for those whales.
Well, let's also talk about, on July 31st, there was a NOAA vessel, the Oscar Dyson, which is a research vessel, that headed out on a quest to try to track down these animals, find them, and learn something. Tell us about that recent effort and what has happened so far.
That's correct. The Oscar Dyson left Dutch Harbor on July 31st to try to locate right whales and then place satellite transmitters on those whales so we could track their movements. The The way it works is we have a group of scientists that is doing visual surveys. In other words, they stay on a high platforms on the ship looking for whales using special binoculars that we call big eyes. Those are long-range binoculars. And we also have a team of acousticians, which are dropping hydrophones in the water and try to hear right whale calls. So we pretty much survey the outer continental shelf west of Bristol Bay in the Bering Sea, which corresponds both to the critical habitat, the known critical habitat for right whales, and also the North Aleutian Basin lease area. And so we survey those areas looking for those whales. We've completed the first leg of the survey, and we were not able to locate any whales so far.
Well, now that can be analyzed two different ways. One, that, oh, good, these animals don't spend a lot of time in this area. Or someone else could say, my gosh, that could be very indicative. It could indicate that the animals are in critical state of collapse at this point. Any interpretation of that at this point?
Well, we actually think it's still very, very premature to take any conclusions in regards to what's going on to this population. The reason is that we just spent 2 weeks in the water, and because this is a small population, it takes time to locate them. The second thing is they might not be there due to some environmental change in the habitat that has just happened this year. For example, let's say this is an year with different oceanographic characteristics in the Bering Sea, and these features have changed, shifted prey distribution, and then prey somewhere else, the whales are somewhere else, and we don't know where they are now. We haven't been able to locate them. Right. So it's still, and that's actually the reason we're doing this study, and this is why this is a long-term study. You know, we're planning to do this for at least 4 years, is because it takes some time to actually locate the whales and then actually obtain information that will be sufficient for us to tell what the status of the population, what might be going on.
Mm-hmm.
So we see this as a very, very long term research project. We're still doing the first 2 weeks of this long study. So it's still very, very premature to make conclusions.
Just
it is true it's an endangered population, but we still need a lot more information to actually say what's going on.
Just curious, the acoustic microphones, the hydrophones, how far would you estimate you could listen through the oceans? I know the whale song or calls very often carry many miles, but in this particular case, I'm curious what your thoughts are in terms of the right whales and their calls.
It depends a lot on the properties of the water and other features like depth. In shallower waters, you can listen further away, and in the deeper waters, you can't go that far. In the area that we have been working, we believe that we can listen to the whales to distances of 50 to 60 kilometers from the boat.
Now, let's also talk about, in terms of the oil and gas leases, this would be offshore, probably derricks and things, and just the reality is, and we're trying to deal with realities here, first of all, the construction of those and probably the operation and maintenance of them, it creates a lot of noise, which unfortunately, I don't have the science, perhaps you do, it could affect the capacity for these very few animals to communicate effectively with each other. Any thoughts about the effect of, for example, the construction of oil and gas derricks and how that might affect the animals' communication?
This is not my area of expertise, so I can't tell you much about it. It is true that noise could affect whales in many different ways, including communication. It depends on the level of noise that is created and the distance the animals are from the source of noise. So there is a lot of variables there that you need to assess before you can actually say what the potential impact is. And we certainly can provide more information about the potential impact after this long-term study. But it's still, again, it's still difficult to say what kind of impact we could get on, not only on right whales, but in any populations at this point.
And I can appreciate that. You're saying you don't really know. And
yes, exactly. We know noise can potentially cause impacts to whales in general, to, you know, marine life in general. I'm just saying we don't know for this particular species. And again, this is not my area of expertise. I'm not an expert in noise and noise pollution in the ocean. So
yes.
I can't tell you much.
Yes. One question that I would have as well, have you been able to see a map with potentially proposed distribution of these oil and gas leases?
We have a map of what is called the North Aleutian Basin lease sales area. Within that area, I don't know whether there are smaller sub-areas where oil exploration or production is proposed for the near term, like within a short period of time.
Part of the process of determining where those wells would go, this is my commentary, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Part of that process would be a sonar soundings. And as it's been fairly well proven that those can dramatically affect ocean mammals in particular. And so I suppose part of the process prior to the letting of the leases would be these massive sonar survey of that area. And that could be difficult for whales specifically. Talk a little bit about what we do know about the whales. For example, I know there's a terrific bonding between the mother and the calf. What are the areas of the right whale that fascinate you the most?
In baleen whales in general, the bonding of the females with the calves occur in the early months of life. You know, after about a year and a half, the calves and the mother separate, and they don't, in many cases, they don't see each other at all again. What fascinates me about this population is that it's small and it's thriving to recover. And we've seen in many other places in the world that heavily hunted populations of whales, like, for example, humpback whales or even right whales in the southern hemisphere, they are in the process of recovering. So populations were reduced to very, very small sizes, and then today they have shown signs that they are growing, and then they are reoccupying historical areas of distribution, historical whaling grounds. In this particular case of the eastern North Pacific right whale population, we haven't seen that yet. And so what is very interesting is to understand why this is going on. And then this is, I think, one of the long-term objectives of this study is to actually follow these whales and find out why they haven't recovered like other populations in other areas.
This is where the estimates of the population become frightening. Estimates of the current population of northern right whales is, well, again, it's speculative, but somewhere between 50 and 100 animals. That is a frighteningly low population. What are your thoughts about that level of population and its capacity to endure?
That's a good question. It's hard to say. It's very hard to say. It is concerning that the numbers are so small, and the fact that we haven't seen very many right whales in the past. But it is possible that they recover. It is encouraging that, for example, we've recently in the last 3 or 4 years we've seen females with calves. For a long time we didn't see right whale calves. And then in recent surveys, we have been able to actually photograph some small individuals. So the fact that we're now starting to see calves, and then we know there are both females and males in the population, is encouraging. But it's still going to take a substantial amount of time. If this population recovers, it's going to take a substantial amount of time for that to happen. And we don't know whether they will be able to recover to the same level of population that they were if they were hunted. But again, it's very difficult to say for sure what's going to happen with the current amount of data we have.
We don't know that much about their literal behaviors. Do we know much about the mating habits of male-female right whales?
Not for this population.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And we don't even know where this population goes for breeding.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of the basic questions that we're trying to answer with this study.
In terms of this area around the Bering Sea, have males been spotted in that area?
Yeah, males have been spotted in the area. Females have been spotted in the area. And calves have been spotted in the area.
Mm-hmm.
This is primarily a feeding area.
Mm-hmm.
Right whales eat primarily zooplankton. and this is an area where they can come and find their prey. And so they tend to spend a substantial amount of time, especially this summer and early spring, these areas, mm-hmm. because that's when biological production is higher, and that's when they can take advantage of the abundance of prey. So the Bering Sea and probably the Gulf of Alaska are important feeding grounds for this population. We don't know whether breeding occurred there, and it's very unlikely because of the seasonal cycle of this whales. But again, we don't know also whether we don't know where they go for breeding.
How do you intend to now move forward at this point on the research on the right whales?
Well, what we want to do, there's a substantial amount of information that we would like to collect, but it mostly for the beginning of this project, what we want to do is to actually locate the whales and assess their distribution using the the surveys that we're conducting, the ship surveys, or using also acoustics, that is dropping the hydrophones and listening to the whales. And we also would like to deploy satellite transmitters on the whales and track their movements through both the feeding season and the winter, so we can discover where they go.
Apparently, this has never happened before.
No, this has never happened before. We have no idea where these whales go and what they do. We actually were able to locate whales before. We were able to place satellite transmitters on a couple of individuals earlier in 2004, but we didn't monitor those two individuals until they reached their wintering ground. We were not able to follow those whales until they reached their wintering ground.
I see. Okay,
yeah.
Gotcha.
We were able to follow them for a little less than a couple months when they were still in the feeding ground.
I realize this is not necessarily your job or your forte, but just to whatever degree you wish to discuss this, obviously this is going to become potentially a contentious arena, oil and gas leases offshore in that area and its effect on whales. These are endangered species. If it turned out that 4 years from now you found out that there could be this conflict, do you foresee the possibility that if this truly did have an impact on the whales, that these leases may be postponed?
I think it's a long process, but if it was determined that the oil and gas exploration could threaten this population, there would probably be a lot of pressure to postpone the leases of those areas, yeah.
Right, exactly. Well, that is the way the law is written, and it's there for good purpose.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, unfortunately, particularly a population like this that is so dependent potentially on one specific area, there's always these trade-offs, but mm-hmm. quite honestly, the potential extinction of this population mm-hmm. of species could be dramatically impacted. Well, let's talk a little bit about what other areas is the National Marine Mammal Laboratory working on that you find interesting that people should know more about?
We're involved in a lot of projects. I think, especially for people in Alaska, there's an interesting project going on with ballhead whales near Barrow, which is another area where oil exploration is being considered and it's going on. And it's a study that is focusing on movement and habitat of those whales as well. The lab does studies on killer whales that are very, very interesting too. We are also trying to place satellite transmitters on the whales and locate those whales and see where they go and if there are shifts in distribution according to different potential prey. We do studies with stellar sea lions. In the past, the decline of stellar sea lions in Alaskan waters was a very important issue, and the lab was deeply involved in assessing where the causes of this decline and the potential implications of that for a number of activities. We do a lot of interesting work. We do work with polar seals up north near the Arctic, also involving satellite telemetry and habitat studies. We do a lot of interesting things.
Well, I don't know do you have any underwater subs, the submersibles?
No, we don't.
I wish you did, because what you should do is go up into the North Arctic area and plant some flags under... We won't get into that, but there's such a developing story there. It's an interesting world, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yes. Well, Dr. Alex Zerbini, tell people how they can find out more about the National Marine Mammal Laboratory.
www.afsc.noaa.gov /NMML. People interested are welcome to come and look at all the projects and all the programs that are going on. We have newsletters about the research done not only in the lab but in the whole Alaska Fisheries Science Center. It's a very informative website.
Well, I'm going to keep in touch with you, Dr. Zerbini, to find out how your research is progressing, because this to me is very, very important and also very fascinating.
Well, thank you very much. We appreciate that. We certainly would like people to know what we're doing and what the results of our research are.
Well, we'll have an open channel here with the Wild Side News and the National Marine Mammal Laboratory. Thanks, Dr. Alex Zerbini, for adding your voice here on the Wild Side News.
Thank you very much.
I tell it like I see it, and some will say I'm painting a pretty bleak picture, to which I have to say, it just may be that this is just the beginning. If trends in our weather and the diversity of species on Earth continue as they are now, we will be the generation that will witness a reshuffling of Earth's systems to accommodate these changes. Scare tactics? No. I report. You decide. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios. Until we meet again next Thursday or any time on the archives, when your voice of the Earth rings out around the world, here on the Wild Side News.